And we are back to the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch for Wednesday, April 17th. For the Virginia Voice, your readers are Simon Kelly and Emmett K. Jennings.
Our first article in the opinion section comes from Paul Goldman. Mr. Goldman is... Mr. Goldman is a lawyer, former chairman of the Virginia Democratic Party, and author of Remaking Virginia Politics. He titles his essay, Stoney's Ballpark Plan, A Gamble Richmond Can't Afford. Mayor LeVar Stoney and city council members soon to leave office are hell-bent to use their waning power to put Richmond taxpayers on the hook for $280 million in unprecedented baseball stadium debt financing. Stoney unveiled his proposal on April 8th. He and his council majority say they will ram it through a council meeting on May 8th. But having the right to do it doesn't make it the right thing to do. Richmond elects new leaders this year. Never in Virginia history have city officials, even recently elected, enacted a potential stadium debt bomb in 4 weeks. This guarantees citizens have no time for effective input. Stoney and his political allies justify their actions by saying Major League Baseball officials and the owners of the Richmond Flying Squirrels are not bluffing with their latest ultimatums. One, city leaders must quickly pass a debt financing plan to ensure stadium construction is completed in time for the Squirrels' 2026 season opener. Two, should Richmond leaders balk, the Squirrels will leave, and Major League Baseball has implied Richmond will never get another baseball team. The mayor and his council supporters have recently done similar bullying. Last year, they tried forcing Richmond to accept their flawed casino deal. Casino backers ran what Richmond Times-Dispatch columnist Michael Paul Williams labeled a despicable campaign featuring racist, sexist, and anti-Semitic rants. I led the anti-casino effort that defied these intimidation tactics. Stadium ultimatums are not new to Richmond. In 2005, the Richmond Braves minor league team and Major League Baseball used similar threats, trying to coerce then-Mayor Doug Wilder into backing a costly Shaco Bottom Stadium. They said their proposal wouldn't cost city taxpayers a penny. Wilder tasked me with reviewing this free lunch claim. I spent several months analyzing the proposal. Their free lunch failed the smell test once I figured out who got what and why. Wilder rejected it. Stadium backers said his refusal would cost Richmond millions. The Braves soon headed south after convincing the good old boys in Gwinnett County, Georgia, to swallow their free lunch. The cost of the stadium wound up doubling, attendance waned as ticket prices increased, and the county has been forced to divert tax revenues from other sources to help pay off the bond debt. As I suspected, MLB, despite their ultimatum, later reversed course in Richmond. The AA Squirrels owners have never had it better. They play in our lucrative regional market, formerly reserved for AAA teams. Richmond's chief administrative officer, Stoney's college buddy, admits the $280 million is a risky bet, exposing us to a potential Gwinnett County debacle. But he says residents need to trust City Hall's projection that new tax revenues generated by the ballpark and proposed surrounding development would cover the bet. Remember how former Mayor Dwight Jones forced the Washington Redskins, now Commanders, training camp debacle in Richmond by insisting the team demanded an immediate answer? Those sure bet financial predictions from City Hall later proved patently unrealistic. Government by ultimatum is no way to run a city or choose priorities. In 1955, Richmond leaders promised to obey federal law and modernize Richmond Public Schools facilities for long-denied black students. They promised equal educational opportunities. Stoney and council members made the same campaign promises in 2016 and 2020. It is now 2024. Student learning is sinking, school buildings are crumbling, and the mayor's new budget shortchanges RPS facility maintenance while lacking a plan to modernize facilities. Black children have waited 69 years and counting, so I feel justified in saying Major League Baseball and the Squirrels can wait until 2027. MLB and the Squirrels have long pledged to always be respectful, good neighbors. In that spirit, let me offer a cooperative alternative decision by confrontation. First, Richmond leaders accept opening day 2027 as a firm final deadline. Second, this November, after a reasoned debate, citizens get to vote on a baseball stadium referendum. State law allows council to work on the precise wording until August 1st. Personally, I oppose demolishing the Diamond. Modern-day baseball stadiums are designed very differently. The Diamond is now an iconic structure worth saving. But I trust the people to do what's best for Richmond. There are several fiscally responsible stadium plans available. I encourage the mayor to ask MLB and the Squirrels to embrace neighborly cooperation for the next few months. Everybody wins. But should they remain intransigent, I am prepared for the Squirrels to leave if they aren't bluffing. This opinion piece, written by Paul Goldman, Stoney's Ballpark Plan. Stoney's $280 million stadium bet is a gamble RVA cannot afford. Mr. Goldman is a lawyer, former chairman of the Virginia Democratic Party, and author of Remaking Virginia Politics. Simon?
Thank you, Emmett. The second opinion piece today is on the subject of college admissions. It's written by two people. Brenda Poggendorf is vice president for enrollment management at Randolph-Macon College, and Jason Ferguson is dean of admissions at Longwood University. The piece is titled, How to Navigate Delays and Botched FA-FSA Rollout. Virginia's college-bound high school seniors and families each spring decide which college or university to call home for the next 4 years. Typically, students choose between in-state or out-of-state, and whether to attend a large public university or a small non-profit private college. While this selection process is complex enough for a high school senior, in 2024, prospective students and families are also experiencing new concerns about affordability, brought on by complications from the latest so-called Better FAFSA, which stands for Free Application for Federal Student Aid. The admissions process naturally combines excitement with anxiety, and even some celebration or disappointment. But the federal government should not make it more difficult. Please make no mistake. As career admissions officers, we applaud Congress's policy initiative to streamline FAFSA. With fewer complicated questions and a new calculation called the Student Aid Index, or SAI, millions more students, including first-generation students and those from lower incomes, will qualify for federal aid and loans and access greater social mobility through higher education. However, when the Federal Department of Education revised the FAFSA form following the passage of the 2020 FAFSA Simplification Act, the result was a delayed application unavailable until December 31, 2023. Subsequent delays and unanticipated technology snafus meant that colleges and universities only now started to receive applicant financial information, causing a rush to assemble competitive aid packages for timely and informed decision-making. In prior years, students filled the FAFSA out as early as October, and colleges and universities sent financial aid award notifications in late fall. Once spring arrived, students compared each college's award to discern the best financial fit among other decision-making factors. Many students have not and may not receive financial aid award notifications until late this month or even into May. Those of us who have long worked in the college admissions and financial aid field expect that every year will bring new challenges, so we work to incorporate flexibility into processes. Still, this improved application delivery has left colleges, universities, and families in limbo. While neither public nor non-profit private institutions created the current predicament, admissions and financial aid offices are working overtime to help bring this cycle to a successful conclusion for students to make the best financial choice and the best match for their interests, talents, and aspirations. What can students and families do while waiting for financial aid awards? If one has not filled out the FAFSA, do it as soon as possible. Then use this time to visit colleges, even a second time. To ease anxieties, Virginia's public and non-profit private institutions are committed to transparency and communication during these trying times, including timely updates and resources to help students and families navigate the process with as much confidence as possible. So stay connected with the colleges still under consideration and watch websites, emails, and texts for updates on how to navigate the aid process best and learn the timelines. Many institutions offer flexibility around the May 1st deposit deadline to ease anxieties. Meanwhile, our institutions are preparing financial aid packages to produce offers for thousands of students with a more compressed schedule. This task would normally occur over months, but now must be ready in a few weeks. We must also complete the financial aid awarding process for all returning students before billing occurs. Applicants will remain the top priority over the coming weeks, and soon everyone will have a campus family in the fall, along with a roommate and residence hall assignment, faculty advising pairings, first year course offerings, and orientation program schedules. To students and parents dealing with the FAFSA delays and feeling like everything is falling apart, please know that we in colleges and universities have been through tough times and have always made it through. We encourage you to lean on the available support systems. Students and families do not have to endure this alone, but patience is vital. Soon, financial aid offers will be sent to emails and mailboxes. We hope families and schools can be understanding and kind to each other. Despite the challenges of FAFSA, Virginia colleges and universities are working hard to help every student find the best college for them. And that opinion piece was written by Brenda Pogendorf of Randolph-Macon College and Jason Ferguson of Longwood University. And their piece was titled, College Admissions, How to Navigate Delays, Botched FAFSA Rollout.
We have two letters to the editor today. And the first one is from Dr. Richard K. Sterling, Chief Clinical Officer of the Stravitz-Sanyal Institute for Liver Disease and Metabolic Health at VCU. His letter is titled, Liver Disease Treatment is Finally Available. April 29th is the first World Liver Day that millions of patients with a common liver disease can celebrate with the knowledge that a drug is finally available to treat their disease. Contrary to popular thought, liver disease does in fact affect those who do not drink alcohol. A form of liver disease involving the accumulation of fat affects up to 30% of adults who don't drink. This disease is often associated with metabolic dysfunction such as diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and elevated triglycerides. The severe form of the disease, in which patients' livers are also inflamed and scarred, is called metabolic dysfunction-associated steatohepatitis, or MASH. This serious and progressive liver disease can lead to cirrhosis, liver cancer, or even liver transplantation. Until recently, there were no FDA-approved therapies and patient treatment focused on weight loss and lifestyle changes. That all changed on March 14th when the Federal Food and Drug Administration approved resmetirom, brand name known as Rezdiffra, a once-daily oral drug that, along with lifestyle changes, significantly improves the health of liver patients. The Stravets-Sanyal Institute for Liver Disease and Metabolic Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, a globally renowned research and treatment center, and some of our patients participated in this trial. Although resmetirom did not improve all patients treated, this major milestone brings hope to the millions with MASH and paves the way for other treatments now in clinical trials. Only by screening all adults for liver disease, such as a simple, inexpensive, and non-invasive test developed at VCU called the FIB-4 Index, regardless of risk or elevated liver blood tests, we will be able to identify patients in the early stages of liver disease. With this new drug and potential therapies to come, we can celebrate future World Liver Days as we help reduce the number of those who desperately need a liver transplant and improve the health of our population. This letter to the editor, titled Liver Disease Treatment is Finally Available, is written by Dr. Richard K. Sterling, Chief Clinical Officer of the Stravets-Sanyal Institute for Liver Disease and Metabolic Health at VCU.
And the second letter today comes from Robert Hollier of Manikin Sabbat, his letter titled, Youngkin, Right to Question Racial Literacy Courses. It is simply a fact that educational institutions over the past 50 years have lost the confidence of a significant portion of the American public. To regain that trust, there is no alternative to getting down in the weeds, examining the evidence, and making the case that the suspicions are unfounded. What will not restore trust is to be told to trust the experts. This only confirms the suspicions and increases the mistrust by implying that non-experts are incapable of assessing the evidence if it is presented clearly and accurately. And it is not lost on many non-experts that experts do not always agree with one another. Which expert should we trust? Case in point is the growing mistrust of how educational institutions are handling issues of race, gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Many believe that what is being offered as the academic study of these issues is rather the promulgation of a certain ideological point of view, lacking a careful review of all the evidence and the sympathetic presentation and critical evaluation of alternative perspectives. Governor Glenn Youngkin has his suspicions about the appropriateness of VCU's new courses on racial literacy, which would eventually be required of new students, and has asked to review the course materials. The wide-ranging broadside by Senator Lamont Bagby and Ayanna Moore, Youngkin Stop Policing Our Classrooms, published on April the 7th, boils down the familiar and unhelpful refrain, trust the experts. However, their description of the course goals only increases suspicion. To empower students to challenge institutional racism, to promote equity, and to foster socially conscious professionals prepared for societal change. These sound like the goals not of an academic course, but of a program of ideologically driven social change. I am reassured that Governor Youngkin is going to review the course. I hope he does so fairly and reports his findings. That letter from Robert Hollier of Manikin Sabbat.
Thank you, Simon. Turning now to more news of a local interest. This from page 4 of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch. Virginia could do more to hold down overtime costs, the Inspector General says. The story written by Dave Ress of the newspaper. Virginia could put some $50 million of taxpayer funds to better use by tighter oversight of overtime payments and trying a new approach at behavioral health facilities, the Office of the Inspector General said. It found that Virginia state agencies' overtime payments for the 11 months that ended May 31, 2023, had increased by 90%. Since the 2010 decision to leave overtime pay decisions with individual state agencies instead of the state's Central Personnel Management Office. That increase is not adjusted for the pay increases state employees have received over these dozen years. State agencies have spent more than $90 million a year on overtime for five of the past 6 years, OSIG reported. The office's performance audit of 21 state agencies found two specific examples of cost savings. They included an estimated $6.5 million in the state's behavioral health facilities, its eight adult mental hospitals as well as its children's facility, its training center for people with developmental disabilities, its rehabilitation center for sexual offenders, and its medical center, could follow a private sector approach for direct care staff workloads with three weekly shifts of 12 hours each. The audit also found 16 of 19 timesheets it reviewed at the Department of Health did not have enough documentation to justify overtime payments, resulting in $399,442 of questioned costs. The Department of Behavioral Health and Development Services has been testing the three-shift approach since 2020 at Western State Hospital in Stanton, where 10 direct care staff volunteered to work the three-shift schedule in one ward while receiving pay for a four-hour supplemental shift. That supplemental shift was needed to ensure they were paid for 40 hours of work a week. The state does not allow employees to receive full-time employees' benefits if they work fewer than 40 hours a week. The three-shift schedule, without the supplement, would come to just 36 hours. The volunteers' shift schedule cut overtime costs on the ward by 36%, which the Inspector General said would translate to a nearly $6.5 million reduction system-wide across all the department's 12 facilities if it had been put in place in 2022. The department's overtime costs have increased from a bit more than $5 million in 2010 to about $20 million in 2022, the Inspector General's report noted. DBHDS facilities have experienced increased overtime costs and are at a disadvantage while recruiting and retaining staff. This is in part because they are unable to schedule direct care staff similar to the industry standards utilized by private sector hospitals, the audit report said. The Behavioral Health Department said it agreed with OSIG findings and recommendation to work with the Department of Human Resource Management to move to a three-shift model. The Inspector General's audit also found that the Department of Human Resource Management should review its overtime pay guidelines to include minimum internal control requirements, including procedures for monitoring overtime. In addition, the department should require that state agencies have documented overtime policies, the audit said. At the health department, in addition to the lack of documentation on timesheets, the audit found that the department did not always pay overtime in a timely way, the audit found. In an earlier report, the Auditor of Public Accounts also identified problems with the Department of Health's ability to pay overtime in a prompt manner. In an audit of the fiscal year that ended in June 2022, the auditor determined some employees received lump sum payments several months or years after they worked the overtime. As of November 2022, there were still 160 employees waiting to get paid for their overtime work. The health department had been under stress for the pandemic, the report noted. The Inspector General also found the state police timekeeping process is duplicative with two separate reviews of timesheets. Patrick Henry Community College was not keeping all its adjunct staff's timesheets for the required 5 years. The Health Department and Virginia Racing Commission were not including dates on timesheet signatures. OSIG supports the use of overtime when it's appropriate, said State Inspector General Michael Westfall. This report simply highlights the need for stronger policies and communicating those policies. This story from page 4 of today's Richmond Times-Dispatch involving government politics. Virginia could do more to hold down overtime costs, Inspector General says. This article was written by journalist Dave Ress of the newspaper.
Thank you, Emmett. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be back in a moment with today's obituaries and more news.